Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and back in the flesh, but not in studio, but in my heart, the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, man?
Hey, man. It was a very heavily qualified presence, I suppose, that I have.
We had Dr. Miles on the podcast last week, and I was like, what, like, where do you think you rank as far as like handsomeness level? And he's like, outside the top 10. And I'm like, yeah, that's a good enough caveat. But no, I'm glad that you're back on. This is a little bit different than something we've done previously. We were thinking about doing another science review, but we figured we'd take it to the people. Let's ask the people, what do you want to talk about? And they submitted a bunch of questions to your Instagram. So if you guys don't follow Austin or don't follow myself, you should do that on Instagram, because we might answer your question directly right here in, you know, in memoriam on our podcast. And so that's what we're going to do today. We got a lot of questions. So instead of just, you know, flapping our jaws about stuff that people weren't asking, let's just get into it. All right. So question number one, could you provide a high level overview of your current training? And then I do like this qualifier at the end, but what does your accessory work look like? It's like, wait a minute. Like, what?
High level or not high level?
Yeah, right. It's like, hold on. All right. So yeah, why don't you do yours first, and then I'll do mine, and we can see if where the Venn diagram is.
Sure. I feel like, I don't know, it's been an interesting progression. I feel like I'm getting a bunch of these kinds of questions more frequently these days, both related to training and some of the like diet, nutrition sort of thing. And I suspect that some of it's coming from like some of the numbers that I've been putting up recently, but the impression that people seem to have is that I'm making like much more rapid progress than I have before, which is not the case. I just think that some of it is like maybe more attention getting or something, and people think I'm making faster progress than I really am. And so I get a lot of these questions of what does my training look like? And really it's like, if I'm being honest, my overall training structure, my weekly training, what I do has changed minimally for all, like over a year and a half, maybe even more than that, with like pretty trivial changes from week to week or month to month, nothing really of great significance. And pretty similar with my diet, which is another question we'll get to a little bit later, but it just seems to be getting people's attention. So overall, the training structure that I've used for, yeah, I think at least a year and a half, going on 2 years now, I changed from what I had done previously, where I used to, you know, when I first was getting started, I would train to like 3 days a week and then 4 days a week, big lifts, like pretty much every session, full body training on the compound movements pretty much every session. Now, what I've been doing for a while is I've been training typically 6 days a week with a bit of a different distribution of the training stimulus and heavy and light stuff throughout the week. So Monday, I typically do a full, like what people can refer to as an SBD day, a full, you know, squat, bench, and typically a sumo or some other kind of supplemental deadlift movement at the end of that session. Both Tuesday and Wednesday tend to be lighter sessions where I do some very light overhead pressing, some of the accessory stuff, which was part of the question, lat pull downs, good mornings, single leg RDLs, maybe some split squats if I can talk myself into doing them, cable rows, maybe even some push-ups, things like that. All in all, like the Tuesday and Wednesday sessions are very like low stress, low fatigue, but end up being kind of more of a full body, sort of like a pump thing, if you want to call it that. It keeps me moving, feeling good, probably builds up some capacity in various areas, and facilitates probably some recovery from the stress of the full squat, bench, deadlift session on Monday. Thursday ends up being a deadlift and bench session, usually my comp deadlift and a reverse grip bench as the main lifts, with some more like lat pull down or various like upper back arm stuff, whatever the case is. Friday will be a squat variation and some overhead pressing again. My overhead pressing is extremely light, literally like 135 pounds, because I don't care about the press, but I'm just using it as a way to keep things moving in different ways and keep everything happy. And then Saturday is another light accessory session. I'll do RDLs. I'll do more of the similar types of accessory type movements, and then a bench exposure again, usually like pause bench for triples or something like that. So those 6 days, the heavy days tend to be Monday, Thursday, light days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday. And then the main kind of approach to the main competition movements involves working up to usually something like a heavy-ish single in the RPE 7 to 8, maybe a 9 range. And then I'll take off about 25% off the bar and do anywhere from 4 to 6 sets of 3 to 4 reps. And so my overall rep ranges on my main movements, really, I do not go above 4, and I have not in a very long time. And then on all the supplemental stuff, like lat pull downs and all that other kind of stuff, typically it's more like 10, 12, 15, something like that. So that ends up being something that I've just kind of gravitated towards over time. It balances kind of the distribution of stress throughout the week. I seem to tolerate it really well. And I don't force any kind of progression, really, ever. I just take what's there on any given day and just kind of ride the waves up and down over time as life stress, work stress, whatever. Maybe things bump down a little bit, and then things perk back up shortly after that. And then long term, things just seem to generally be gravitating upwards. But having that like emotional detachment from the weights on any given day has been super helpful. And I've felt something that I think I've talked about before, like getting a sense of what your bottom end strength is as like a more useful metric, like what's a decent, like any day lift, not like what am I on my best day. And I've felt that like, oh, now if I go to, you know, train my deadlift or something, any day where I pull less than, I don't know, 660, for example, is like, not too hot today. And then in that, like maybe 660 to 690 range or something, I'm like, okay, that's, you know, a decent like average day at this point. And then anything above that, I'm like, oh, I'm like reasonably strong today. And I felt that like floor kind of rise gradually over time with all the training accumulation, all the exposure, all the practice with singles, doubles, triples, and really, again, nothing over 4, I think has kind of developed that. So that's just something that I've gravitated towards, seems to work reasonably well for me. Absolutely no guarantee it will work for anybody else listening to this, even though they're guaranteed to have some people try it. It comes with no guarantees. Your mileage may vary, as they say. But since we were getting hammered with these questions, I figured we'd just put it out there. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, when people are asking, the assumption is that if I find out this top secret Baraki program, then I too will share in this trajectory. And I think what people should understand is that you're not taking any of the principles that we've designed, like any of the templates or doing any of our coaching through, and just like throwing them out the window. You're just taking them and tweaking them to your preferred schedule, your sort of adaptive capacity over time and preferences. So like, for example, my current training looks a lot like the low fatigue templates henceforth, like that this is where they came from. Right. And so if somebody was like looking to use that sort of approach, you could start there and take for example, the 4-day low, low intraset fatigue or medium intraset fatigue and spread it out over 6 days. It would look pretty similar to what your training actually is. But I will say this, look, man, if you're in your first year, 2 years of training, just take the last 10 minutes of your life and erase it.
Neuralize like yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not for you. And I liked when people are super stoked on training. They want to learn. They're jazzed up. But that conversation is not for you. And I'm not trying to like say, oh, we got novices, intermediates, advanced. And like, you can't use these, all the principles are the same. But the point is like, you can't possibly know at this point how to adjust your training because you haven't been training long enough. And further, there are some, I guess, developmental steps that you should be going through before you get to this point. I think in general, newer trainees can have a much closer proximity to failure. For example, they're going to need less training volume in general than more advanced trainees or people who've been training for longer. And they're going to have less sort of experience to pull from to be like, this is enough for today. This isn't enough for today. And so that has nothing to do with RPE, by the way. I think newer trainees can rate that in a manner that is effective. But as far as like setting up your own program or programming, you know, your own thing, I don't think that's in the cards in your first few years. And I don't think you necessarily should. Can you live a full and complete life? If you do, sure. But I think if you're looking to really, get the most out of your training, it's probably going to be something that is pre-made or otherwise like administered to you rather than you kind of setting it up yourself. It's just an experience thing and fund of knowledge thing. Even if you were like went to school for this, if you haven't been training that long, I don't know, like how do you create your own program, you know, without having like done it a lot for others coaching and experienced it yourself? Like I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think I would have been able to do this for myself back within my first couple of years of training for sure.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So you're training 6 days a week. I did that in medical school. Like I was just because my sessions ended up being shorter, mm-hmm. right? Like one or two movements or one or two movements and like a body weight kind of thing. Yep. I actually did not like that frequency, even though the sessions were shorter. I mean, I'm doing 4 sessions a week right now, and there's usually 4 or 5 movements. Mm-hmm. And the sessions are longer, especially now with all the conditioning. So my total like training time per day is getting closer to 2.5 to 3 hours, which is a big chunk if you don't happen to work for yourself in the health and fitness industry.
Yeah. And you're training for multiple goals too, which kind of necessitates that amount of time if you're going to be working towards those different things.
Yeah. What is a recipe for like the longest training sessions ever? Like be fairly well trained, right? Have multiple training goals, and then also have like lots and lots of resources to like go training. And so here we are. But yeah, I think for people listening to this, they're like, all right, so I just listened to 12 minutes of these two dudes talking about program principles. What do? It's like, all right, so my recommendation would be if you're curious on this low fatigue template, the ebook associated with it, like lays all this out like fairly clearly. And then you can adjust that iteratively based on your feedback. But again, if you're in your first year or two of training, I don't necessarily know that should be any more than like a curiosity, and maybe you explore that on a cerebral level rather than like, I need this program. It's like, you probably don't.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. As always, learn nothing from these podcasts. No. All right. Question number 2 on the internet. Internet's going to hate us for this. I can feel it already. Are seed oils really bad for you? Are they killing testosterone or causing sunburn? Just a brief thought on the last part. Have you been sunning your taint?
I can't say that I have.
Okay. Well, I've been told that if you'd have the vitamin D and the ultraviolet rays directly like directed at the perineum, then you get localized vitamin D generation. And then that goes directly to the testicles, which ultimately increases testosterone.
I must have missed that physiology of how focal that vitamin D, you know, hotspot is.
But doesn't that sound plausible? Like, don't you think that you could, you might read that on Twitter somewhere? Like somebody would be like, see, this is the mechanism. This is why you got to do it. This is why you got to sun your yoni.
Yeah. It sounds plausible if you don't know anything about the topic.
It's just like, it's like it's just that mechanistic masturbation thing that you share with me. That's what it is. Like, people will make up, even if they're not made up mechanisms, they're, you know, known mechanisms, but it's like the mechanism's one thing, but the clinical outcome and therefore clinical importance, so like what happens in the real world, you know, to patients, to individuals, that's the thing that matters more. And people will spend hours and hours debating mechanisms. And it's like, dude, we have clinical outcome studies, like where we look at what happens in the real world. And so while the mechanisms may be interesting, stimulating, let's look at the clinical data if we're trying to figure out what to actually do. So on this question, I'm gonna let you get into this, but the very simple answer, are seed oils really bad for you? No, they are not. No, they are not. And if you look at data set after data set after data set of actual humans consuming seed oil, and you see a reduced risk of, for example, cardiovascular disease, particularly if you're replacing things like saturated fat. Now, obviously, just if you're looking at cross-sectional data, so just, you know, a snapshot in time of people, and you look at seed oil, you know, versus other sorts of fatty acids intake, the results are less clear. But that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about advising people to eat more seed oils, so to speak, or non-unsaturated fats. And what happens? Because you're replacing the fat with something, right? That's the whole idea. And so in any case, I just find when people geek out on this, they're like, seed oils are death, industrialized seed oils are going to kill you. It's like, cool. That is a fine hypothesis to have, minus the fear mongering. But where the F is your data? Because every interventional data set that we have where they take saturated fat and they replace it with seed oils, unsaturated fat, you see a decrease in cardiovascular risk metrics, and or if they follow them long enough, actual mortality, which is that's what you're looking at, man. I'll link a few of those papers in the description. This latest one that I like is from Circulation in 2019. It's a meta-analysis of 30 studies on incident cardiovascular disease and mortality with seed oil replacement in the diet. So in any case, Austin, we actually did a video on this, but I know you've like actually committed yourself to doing some more in-depth research on this. So yeah. What's your take on this question?
And to your earlier point, I mean, I think that that tweet discussion that I shared with you is worth just mentioning, because this mechanistic topic is one that obviously gets me going. And so this guy named Jonathan Jarry, his at Cracked Science on Twitter is his handle. He wrote, this was actually 2 days ago, he wrote, there's a fascinating phenomenon in the complementary and alternative medicine literature we would call mechanism masturbation, where the authors, faced with the tiniest of positive signals in a small study, write paragraph after paragraph hypothesizing how, mechanistically, watermelon seeds might cure schizophrenia. It may interfere with the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. One of its compounds binds to alpha receptors in the cell type, could play a role in this cascade. Anyway, preliminary results from an N=6 study. More studies are needed. And this is, it's kind of like a satirical take, but it's not actually that far from the reality of what we see from a lot of people who do kind of just thrive on cranking out content based on these really tiny mechanistic sort of papers that look at, you know, whether it's in vitro or some sort of cell signaling mechanism, rather than like what actually happens to real humans with real outcomes that people care about. And we have been no strangers, or we have not been shy about firing shots on this topic, but literally like Rhonda Patrick's entire Instagram page, you scroll through the whole thing and it's like 90% mechanistic masturbation of stuff. Dude. That is not real humans with real outcomes that we care about. It's more of this either mechanistic stuff or observational stuff that is inappropriately turned into recommendations when you can't make recommendations based on the observational thing. Like you showed me, I think you shared with me something that was posted about DHA levels, or just a type of quote unquote fish oil. But it's negatively, or it's inversely associated with risk of Alzheimer's disease or something like that, and using that as justification for supplementation. But there are tons of data sets, be it this relationship between DHA and Alzheimer's risk, or vitamin D and literally anything, as we've talked about in previous podcasts, where it's like these two things correlate either directly or inversely. You can't use that to say, oh, well, as a result, you should supplement this thing to reduce that risk. That would be something you'd have to show separately.
It's a separate. Yeah. It's like you can find something as higher or lower and it's correlated with another thing. That happens all the time.
Yeah.
But then fixing that thing, intervening, you have to show that the intervention actually not only corrects whatever the correlation was, but then also actually improves the clinical outcome.
Right.
Exactly. Because if I ask you, Dr. Austin Brockie, do you give one shit what your vitamin D level is. And you're like, not really. I care more about the clinical outcomes associated with vitamin D status, right? Do I have normal bone mineral density? Are my kidneys working? Do I have normal, you know, muscle mass, muscle function, all these other sort of things? And if so, you're assuming that despite maybe a low serum vitamin D level, everything else, the compensatory redundant mechanisms that have been handed down through evolutionary history are doing their job and allowing you to, you know, survive and ultimately reproduce or not. So, but that's the same thing with this seed oil deal, right? It's like you have maybe some metrics that get worse in cross-sectional data with a diet high in seed oil, as long as it's also high in like refined sugar, for example, or like, you know, other high elements of highly processed foods. Like, because in general, that all goes together. But if you have people eating a lot of like olive oil or rapeseed oil or canola oil or whatever, you know, alongside like lean proteins, vegetables, fruits or whatever, like those things don't happen. Thing one.
Yeah,
thing two, right. When you replace like a diet that's high in saturated fat with more olive oil or rapeseed oil or canola oil, it's not like their blood metrics, like lipids, for example, or A1C or whatever, blood pressure or whatever, get worse. They get better. But even that, you're like, okay, cool. But what about like cardiovascular disease? Like, do they have more heart attacks, less heart attacks, more strokes, less strokes? And it's like, huh, it'd be cool if somebody did like a longitudinal study, like long-term mm-hmm. on this. Oh, wait, they did. And yeah. People are better. And this, yeah. And so at that point, the only logical thing to do is say, my assumption that reducing seed oil intake improves health outcomes is flawed. I have to either adjust it, reject it, or otherwise modify, you know, do something to keep having this idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is just the latest in a long string of dietary villains that a lot of diet subcultures choose to attack. I mean, at one point it was, you know, was it whether it was sugar or fat or carbs or whatever, all the things that paleo people tend to villainize. And it's the current iteration is seed oils. And obviously our hope is that this will eventually pass. But the basic idea of these seed oils, for people who have never heard even this term, it's probably not a great term, honestly, but it's many of the polyunsaturated fatty acid sources that you may have that you mentioned earlier, to include things like canola oil, characterized by having a high content of a particular fatty acid called linoleic acid. And these unsaturated fats, the chemical structure of them contains double bonds, which makes them more fluid, bendier, and it results in these fats being liquid oils, as opposed to more saturated types that are more linear, packed together tightly, and tend to be more solid, particularly at a particular temperature, like butter, for example. And so there are lots of potential mechanisms by which you could hypothesize, you could guess that, hey, maybe these unsaturated fats, because they're have these double bonds and they're more prone to oxidation and things like that, they could cause harm. And that's a testable hypothesis. So you could take people who are consuming high saturated fat diets and replace them with polyunsaturated or vice versa, and look not just at markers of some sort of fatty acid oxidation, but rather at what actually happens to things people care about. People cannot feel the level of oxidation that is happening in their in their fatty acid lipid membranes or something, even though people, you know, in this scene think they can. They think that, you know, this makes me feel bad or something, even though it's probably more of a nocebo type thing when they are aware that they're consuming these things. Rather, things you can feel or experience are things like cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, strokes, and death, and fatty liver disease, and things like that, that can be much more problematic. And so when we actually look at data in humans doing these dietary substitutions on those particular outcomes, we see really consistent evidence, not just from an intervention standpoint, we also see it from a mechanistic standpoint. We also see it from an epidemiologic standpoint. We have these, what we call multiple lines of converging evidence, all pointing generally in the same direction. When you replace high intakes of animal-derived saturated fats with these unsaturated fat sources, like foods from seed oils or fish or plant sources, things like that. We see improvements in blood lipids, blood cholesterol levels. One way is that they upregulate, they improve the function of the LDL receptor. We see decreases in liver fat in patients who have fatty liver disease. We see decreases in cardiovascular risk and a number of other findings, again, quite consistently across broad ranges of data sets and study types. And then even if you were to look at the actual mechanisms that are posited, for example, this idea that these polyunsaturated fats are much more prone to oxidation, it's like there's data where they've manipulated linoleic acid intake by like over 500% in up or down in directions, and we don't really see changes in inflammatory markers. And they've done even radio tracer studies, and it's like humans only actually convert like 0.2% of their dietary linoleic acid to the supposed inflammatory baddies, like arachidonic acid, for example. I could go on. I mean, this has been beaten to death in other avenues by other people as well. So we could go on for hours on this. But when I hear people in typically like the lower carb type scene, for example, keto diet scene, say that these types of oils are very harmful based on these mechanistic things, that I can throw out the window. When they say that I eliminated all of these foods from my diet and I got way healthier, my next question is, I don't actually doubt that, but the question is, what were the food sources of this that you were actually consuming? Because unfortunately, the reality is that many of these types of oils are used in junk food. And so no shit when people eliminate a bunch of junk food from their diets that they get better. These people are not typically getting their unsaturated fats. They're not typically, you know, their prior diet did not involve chugging half a bottle of canola oil. And that's why they were doing poorly, although that would probably not be great on multiple fronts to include, you know, time on the toilet and things like that. Elimination of all of those food sources, it's changing a lot more things in your diet than just this single variable. And so isolating all the supposed harm to the single variable, particularly in the face of all this other evidence where when we manipulate this one variable, we see things improve, it doesn't make any sense. It's not a justifiable conclusion. So ultimately, we do not have concerns with this. We don't necessarily go out and tell people you should drastically ramp up your intake if you don't want to. If I look at my daily diet, it's not like I'm consuming tons of this, but I'm not afraid of it either. I'm not going out of my way to avoid it or to replace it with high amounts of animal-derived saturated fats, like, you know, taking tons of butter or something like that instead. That would be not the move that I would.
That would be dumb. That would be dumb to advise. Yeah. Yes. That's the important take home. I agree. It's like a low carb bingo. Like if you're like an influencer or a grifter in the low carb space, like there's a handful of things you have to say, and it should be a bingo. It's like, oh, seed oils are death. The lipid heart hypothesis is flawed. Eat more butter. You're like, gosh, you people.
Like, so this is a real complicated, detailed topic for anybody who actually wants to get into the weeds on it. On our Barbell Medicine website, my article Cholesterol Part 3 in particular is lengthy on this. It has a whole section dedicated to this particular topic, section 10, for anybody who wants to follow that up and look into the actual data on this.
Yeah. I'll just say one thing about the testosterone thing. So one, are seed oils reducing testosterone? No. But then also stop worrying about your testosterone. Just like, yes, there are indications to test to get your testosterone levels checked and further manage that clinical hypogonadism. We've got articles on that, videos on that. I feel like we've beaten that to death. But like this idea that you can manipulate your testosterone via a diet or over the dietary pattern change or over the counter sort of supplement, and that's, you're going to feel it or it's going to matter. That is BS. If you change your dietary pattern, you were previously an individual carrying too much body fat, and then you subsequently normalize that, I could make a case for that improving your testosterone levels. But as far as like taking your testosterone levels from the low end of normal to the high end of normal on a particular reading, you're not going to notice that, thing one. And thing two, it doesn't matter. It's not like you're going to get more muscle mass, more strength, more libido, you know, whatever. That doesn't happen. There are complex, redundant homeostatic mechanisms that control how much testosterone you produce, how sensitive you are to that testosterone and its function. The body is very, very complex. So the biggest thing to hurt your testosterone levels and subsequent gains is worrying about your testosterone.
Literally, losing sleep literally over your testosterone.
Seriously. Yeah. If you're worried about it, I can empathize, but I think that I would move you away from, you know, I need to get this measured, I need to replace this, I need to whatever, and start working on your dietary pattern, your programming, sleep, interpersonal relationships, total stress levels, and ways to cope with the stresses of daily life. Those would all be much, much more important than getting your testosterone levels checked, which are likely to be normal. And even if they're on the low end of normal, you're not going to notice any difference from replacing them. And seed oils, no effect on this.
And if they are on the lower end, or frankly low, in the setting of massive life stress, sleep impairment, alcohol use, excess body fat, those are all the things that would be preferable to target before going on some sort of hormone replacement therapy anyway. And incidentally, those are all things that we recommend that people do, whether you get your testosterone levels checked or not. Work on sleep, stress, reducing alcohol use, healthy body fat, body composition. All those things are things you should be doing regardless of what your blood tests show. So,
yeah. Yep. All right. What are the typical intermediate lifter mistakes that you often see? Well, I'm just going to stop you right there. I think the nomenclature, you know, novice, intermediate, advanced, can be useful with people who have a shared understanding of what that word actually means. You know, if you're talking about, oh, they've been training for this amount of time, or these are the typical training characteristics of a person in a particular group. Unfortunately, I don't think that that is a shared language. Like, I think everybody knows when you're saying a beginner lifter, like in general, like that's probably in the first 6 months of their training career. They, you know, are new to this by definition. And then I think if you say advanced, people, you know, kind of have this shared understanding that they've been training for a few years or more and have significant experience. But everything in between, you're like, I don't know what intermediate means. Is that somebody at 6 months of like training age or 24 months of training age? You know, are they lifting twice a week, just meeting the physical activity guidelines, which is fine? Are they lifting 4 days a week and competing? It just, and it doesn't tell you anything about their programming. It's just another label. And so if the label doesn't like clue you in on like who the person is from a training perspective, what they're doing, and ultimately help you make programming decisions, I just don't like, what's the point of the label, right? So the beginner thing I think can be useful for just describing like a person new to training, and advanced can be useful for saying, you know, not new to training. Mm-hmm. But yeah. But I don't think anything further than that you can be ordained from using those terms. Mm-hmm. For example, a beginner and advanced person, my training like paradigm is the same. I want them to train all the major muscle groups multiple times per week through a large range of motion at an intensity that's fairly uncomfortable, using user preferred movements that they'll do, right? So that's, none of that is different, but the dose may be different. But that's going to be individualized anyway. There's going to be some overlap. Mm-hmm. In any case. All right. So what are the typical mistakes? We'll just answer this question. What are the typical mistakes that a person who is not new to training, but has not been training for long, long periods of time, what are the most common mistakes or typical mistakes? I mean, there's just, and I hate to say this because people are gonna be like, you guys are like the two old dudes in the Muppets, like the, the guys in the balcony, you know, like they're all bad. It's like, oh man, well, I'm not trying to be negative. But I mean, there's this field and the sort of advice given, there's a lot of bad stuff out there. And I can understand like where people get confused, particularly if they're just trying to get some sort of guidance relatively quickly, because they don't, you know, this is not what they do for a living, for example. And they're just like, all right, well, what do I want to train today? Or like, how should I adjust my program? So typical mistakes, big ones. I think it's actually kind of a holdover from maybe the beginner phase, is like this sort of misunderstanding of progressive overload and what it is. They're just like, I have to add weight to the bar every single week or every single time I train, or I have to do another rep, or I have to reduce rest time because I have to force the adaptation. And I think it's, again, that just goes back to this misunderstanding of what progressive overload is. The whole point is that every time you train, the amount of stress that you're imparting on yourself should be about the same. And so as your fitness adaptations get, you know, improve and grow larger, you're going to need either more weight, more reps, less rest time, or whatever to kind of meet you where you're at. Subsequently, if your fitness level on a given day is down because you didn't sleep, you know, haven't slept for for an extended period of time, or you're super stressed, or for whatever other reason, it's not there. If you don't adjust the training down to meet you where you're at, you're going to get a better or a worse response from that training. So the biggest mistake that I see is that people are like, no, I have to add the 5 pounds. It's like, it doesn't matter, dude. I've had full, this is true. I've had training blocks that are successful go two different ways and lead me to the same spot. One training block, I'm literally lifting the same weight every week over and over and over and over again. It's getting a little easier, but not easier enough that I want to like add a bunch of weight. It's just like you said at the beginning of this, it's good enough, right? I'm lifting the same amount of weight. But then when it comes time to go to a meet, I'm super strong at the meet. Let's go. I was basically doing enough to drive the adaptations that I wanted, but not too much to like cause a disproportionate amount of fatigue. So I didn't have to add any weight over a 5-week block. I just, you know, kind of kept doing the same thing. And I've also had blocks where I kind of created this artificial momentum. I start like my single progression. It'd be like 1 at 6 on week 1, 1 at 6.5 or 7 on week 2, 1 at 7.5 or 8 on week 3, and build and build. And the last week, yeah, 1 at 9 or something like that before I go to the meet. And so I've added weight to the bar every single time just to kind of like mentally have some momentum built up. And I go in the meet and I do fine. I've had it work both ways. But the point is adding the weight to the bar is not driving the adaptations. Being able to add weight to the bar is a result of the adaptations taking place. And so if I could just do one thing or impart one like piece of knowledge for lifters, it's just that you don't have to add weight to the bar every single time, unless you've gotten stronger, in which case you probably should. And if it's just a little stronger, it probably doesn't matter. If it's a lot stronger, you know, it probably matters more.
Yeah, I think that my main mistake that I was going to mention basically addresses a similar topic, although just coming at it from a different angle. It's this perception of like wasting time that people have. That they feel like they have a very finite amount of time to make progress, or they have to make the fastest progress possible, or that if they're not adding weight to the bar, that the session is a waste of time, which is patently false, completely false. As I mentioned earlier in my own training, like my accessory sessions where I'm doing this like light overhead pressing. I mean, I benched 455 a few weeks ago, and then 3 days a week, I'm overhead pressing literally 135 pounds for sets of three for like 8 triples. And it's like useful work that I'm doing in that session. So I think that this idea that I have to do this as fast as possible, this like emphasis on like quote unquote efficiency, and if I'm not adding weight or reps or something harder every single time, that I'm wasting time, is something that I would challenge pretty heavily, because I think it leads to people making a lot of foolish decisions in their training that ultimately sets them back, whether from, you know, excessive fatigue, inappropriate stress, injury risk, burnout, things like that, compared with where I feel like I am now, where I'm like doing a fair amount of training, things feel good. I care very little about the, you know, day-to-day or week-to-week fluctuations. And I am just as motivated now, like, you know, well over a decade into this, without basically missing any more than like a week of training during that time, as I was at the beginning. And that's something that not a lot of people can say when they're going through this. So I would echo your, you know, mistake just from this different angle of like viewing it as like, oh, I have such little time, I have to do this as fast as possible, because it's not really the case. It's a process that you ultimately have less control over the rate of adaptation than you think. Of course, you can manipulate, you know, your programming and recovery strategies and things like that. But I think I mentioned this in a comment in response to somebody in our group last week who was like frustrated at the rate of progress. And I was like, well, you could try this in your program, could try this. Or it may just be that getting stronger is a slower process than you want it to be. I mean, mm-hmm. Relatable. Like we understand that. So I think that's one of the biggest ones for sure.
Yep. Agreed. All right. Next question. Thoughts on possibilities of resistance training for patients with heart failure? All right. So just for the people listening, do you want to give like a generalized definition of heart failure?
Yeah, heart failure is a scary sounding term. It's one that I don't like using, even though it's the one that we ultimately have to use, because it sounds a lot worse to people who don't understand compared to what it is actually describing. It is a giant category, very broad, heterogeneous, tons of different things fall under the category of heart failure. Ultimately, an impairment in the ability of the heart to effectively fill and or pump blood to the body as it normally would. But it is not failure in that like, oh, my heart stopped beating or something.
It just stopped working.
From like a cardiac arrest or something like that, right? Yeah. So there's a bunch of different kinds, there's a bunch of subtypes, there's like a million causes, and we're discovering new ones all the time. It's something that I see and manage near daily, I feel like in a hospital setting. And historically, it's something that you know, no sane doctor would have previously recommended somebody with heart failure strength train. And part of the reason is this perception that if you exert yourself in that way, it'll raise your blood pressure. If you raise your blood pressure, then your heart has to pump against that. It's called afterload. If you raise the afterload with, an increase in your systemic blood pressure, then the heart that's already maybe having a hard time is going to completely crap out on you in that moment. And so, you know, over time, our understanding of heart failure has changed and evolved a ton. Similar things like years back, it was like, well, you would never, ever put a patient with heart failure on a medicine like a beta blocker, because that can like slow down how much the heart is pumping. It can, you know, potentially weaken a bit of the squeeze or something like that. And again, that was an example of a mechanism, a hypothesis. They're like, well, beta blockers slow down heart rate or squeeze or whatever the case is, and that'd be worse for a heart that's not doing so great. And then they tested that hypothesis and they put patients on these medicines, and all of a sudden they started, you know, dying less and doing much better. And now, like, absolute first line, one of the first most important medicines we put patients with heart failure on, particularly of a certain subtype of heart failure, are these exact medicines that, based on those prior mechanisms, seemed like they would have made them worse, but actually make them better. And that was ultimately for reasons that we did not yet know at the time. And so I view this through a similar lens when it comes to strength training. And I wrote about this for anybody who is in medicine, in our up-to-date article on strength training for health in adults. There's a subsection on heart failure where I basically describe how patients with chronic heart failure have substantial physical disability compared to those without, in both aerobic and muscular kind of capacity. There are tons of changes that happen in the body, both within the heart itself and generalized throughout the body due to neurohormonal effects and metabolic changes and blood flow changes and things like that, ultimately leading to what we've talked about before, anabolic resistance, skeletal muscle wasting in the most advanced stages of heart failure. And so fortunately, now there's more and more evidence, rather than traditional like aerobic-based cardiac rehab, introducing strength training. There's been some pilot studies on this for both of the major subtypes of heart failure. And I cite those data in the up-to-date article as well for those who are interested. And so this is starting to become more well-recognized. So I think that broadly speaking, obviously, you know, there may be individual case-by-case exceptions, things like that. But broadly speaking, I think that this is a feasible exercise modality for patients with heart failure. I think it should be incorporated to improve quality of life, things like VO2 max from an aerobic standpoint, strength, disability, things like that in these patients, alongside all of the medications that we have, the growing number of medications that can like substantially improve heart failure and reduce the risk of death in those patients. So combination of medications and exercise management for this situation is feasible and something that I would generally recommend. Broadly speaking, obviously this is not medical advice for any one particular patient who may be dealing with heart failure, but definitely a thing. And there are growing data sets and research on this topic.
Yeah. I'll actually link this paper that recently came out in 2021. This is in Heart Failure Review Journal, September 2021. So it's called Resistance Training in Heart Failure Patients, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. So a few interesting things point out on this paper. So one, resistance training is actually in the cardiac rehab guidelines like anyway. So just if you were like looking for like precedents, or you're like, I don't feel comfortable reinventing the wheel, it's like, if you actually look at the cardiac rehab guidelines, resistance training is in there. And in any case, this is a systematic review of resistance training on individuals with heart failure in cardiac rehab setting. And the findings were that the safety was if not better than aerobic training. Like, people were able to tolerate resistance training more frequently than aerobic training. And there were no like adverse outcomes in the resistance training arm. They improved their strength, upper body and lower body. They improved their VO2 max, and they improved their functional capacity without any detrimental effect on left ventricular parameters, which is one of like the metrics used to like assess heart failure severity in addition to symptoms. So I'll link that paper and the cardiac rehab guidelines in the description below if you're curious. Like, if you're a clinician listening to this and you deal with heart failure, like, you know more about heart failure than I do, certainly, and like how to manage it in the hospital. But I think, you know, if you're less familiar with the exercise from the exercise side, and you're like, okay, these guys said it on a podcast, like, where do I go? Here. I will direct you there. And then I think that may help change practice. And I think, you know, this is part like a bigger question. And I'm sure your DMs are flooded just like mine are. People were like, hey, I've got this condition, or a family member's got this condition, or a client has this condition I don't know anything about. Can they lift? And it's like, you know, I don't know what the research says on lifting an Arnold Chiari type 2 malformation.
right.
Just because I don't think it exists, right?
Yeah.
But I will say that in general, if an individual is unable to tolerate exercise of any type, that is not compatible with living an independent life. And so, because that means that you can't elevate your blood pressure to do physical activity, you can't move yourself around in your environment independently. You can, I mean, there are all these things that are part of like a normal life and requirements that you have to live independently. And if you can't tolerate exercise, you probably can't do that. And so that may happen transiently with, you know, certain urgent or emergent conditions that need medical intervention. That may happen due to, you know, severe injury or other medical condition. But there are very few, you know, conditions that people live with independently walking around in the world that prevent them from exercise, like that excludes them from exercise. And I, that being said, I understand the risk aversion people have. You're like, wait, this person's got heart failure. Like, I don't know. It seems like it would be bad that exercise, particularly resistance training. I understand that, but I also think that if we're just saying that somebody can't exercise because of a theoretical risk, we probably need to couch that in like, well, how confident do we feel like this is a real risk? And we see that, you see it all the time. Surgical post-op recommendations, don't lift because your blood pressure is going to go up. If you have high blood pressure, it's like, yeah, but lifting actually reduces your resting blood pressure. So yeah. Anyway.
Like, yeah. It's like, I mean, and also always the consideration of like compared to what, so if they can't exercise compared to, you know, the exercise is bad compared to just doing literally nothing. That seems pretty bad for most people, but anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. That's a wrap on episode 182. A little Q&A with Dr. Austin Baraki from questions that you guys submitted to his Instagram. Make sure you follow him, Austin_barbellmedicine, and myself, Jordan_barbellmedicine, for the next time we do one of these Q&As. Next week, we'll have part two of our question and answer session from the users, from the listeners. And so we hope you tune into that. Before you go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you the latest nuance in health and fitness. Once again, this is the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Thanks to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining me on this week's podcast. And we'll see you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. See you.